City Talk 105.9. Official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm. This is The Commons Touch.
The Commons Touch.
On City Talk 105.9.
A very good afternoon from me, Larry Neild, here on City Talk 105.9. This is The Commons Touch, our weekly look at politics here on The Voice of Liverpool. What a week it's been in politics. We've had the American presidential election, history made over there. Gordon Brown is breathing a sigh of relief after the by-election in Scotland. And guess what? If the European Parliament has its way, I won't be working more than a 48-hour week soon. I'll be talking about that later with my guest. I'm joined today by Arlene McCarthy. Arlene is the leading Labour MEP here in the North West, and she represents the North West, Liverpool, Manchester, and the whole area. Arlene, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Arlene, one of your local issues for Liverpool, of course, is you're taking a very big interest in Michael Shields. Why can't you, using your power as an MEP, go in there with a key, let him out tomorrow?
Well, Larry, there are two big issues, actually, that are my core campaigns for Liverpool at the moment. And one is to get Gary Dunn's body back from Spain, as I know some of the listeners will have heard of. And we're making fantastic progress. Gordon Brown spoke to the Spanish Prime Minister on Friday morning, in fact.
What's that case about?
It's an extraordinarily tragic case, in fact. Gary Dunn was a young man who was brutally murdered in Spain. And, of course, his parents have had to go through the ordeal. The terrible ordeal of going through a court case when, in fact, finally they've convicted the man who actually killed Gary. And the issue, of course, has been because it's been a murder trial and because the Spanish wheels of justice, in my view, turned very slowly. It's taken nearly 2 years, and of course the murderer had a very good defence lawyer. And part of that defence team, which we don't understand, was that they insisted on holding Gary's body, as it were, hostage, because they felt that, well, if we needed forensics, etc. Well, I don't know what forensic you can take after somebody dies after a year, but we got the Spanish judicial system to recognise it was unacceptable. They then agreed a year ago, after a lot of lobbying for myself, and Spanish MEPs helped me with it, that Gary would be allowed to come back and find his resting place and have a dignified burial in Liverpool. And then we ran into another problem, which is the local health and safety rules, because Spain has autonomous regions, so Madrid can't decide on some of these issues. The local health and safety rules bizarrely meant that because he had been already buried for nearly 2 years, that they said, well, he can only go back as ashes. And of course, that's not the wishes of Stephen and Leslie Dunn. So what we've done there is we've said very clearly to the Spanish, no, the family have a right in this case to have their son back whichever way they want to. We want the local rules overturned, and we're fighting very hard to get a result on that. And I'm very optimistic now because Gordon Brown himself has stepped in and raised it on Friday with the Spanish Prime Minister that we will eventually get the result we want. As for Michael, as you know, that's been a long-standing campaign. In fact, I got involved in that on the day that he was arrested, and I received... a contact from one of the local papers saying, you know, that what could I do? It was an arrest that happened in Bulgaria around the Champions League final. And you know, we've been continually frustrated, again, in my view, because the Bulgarian justice system really has a lot of weaknesses and is a system basically which... I think wrongly convicted Michael Shields. It is, for me, a very fundamental miscarriage of justice. And again, our campaign was not just to have the decision overturned, but it was, again, to get Michael out of prison. We got him transferred back. That was quite a big result to get him transferred back from Bulgaria so that his family could have access to him, because, of course, it's costing them a fortune to go and visit him in Bulgaria. And now, of course, the campaign has focused really consistently on getting him free and, in effect, in justice for Michael. And what's the difficulty? I mean, we're involved in this kind of legal complex. Yes, I would like, and I'm sure that Maria and Michael Sr. would like to simply go in and turn the key and let him out. The fact is that the Bulgarian system failed him. It failed to give him justice. They've sent him back to Britain saying it's no longer our problem. But when, you know, we have about 3,000 prisoners in UK jails that have been convicted in many other jurisdictions across the European Union. And the deal by which you bring that prisoner back is that you sign the convention that you sign in terms of the transfer, the legal document, legally obliges you as a member state, the government, the justice ministry, to actually make sure that he carries out his sentence. So what we are now saying is that we challenge that convention. We say that we believe that in the convention there are two articles, and that in the case of a miscarriage of justice, it must be possible for the host country, namely the UK, who didn't give down the sentence, also to say we've looked at the merits of this case, we don't believe that the evidence pointed to Michael being the guilty party, and we should be able to release him. Now, what the Bulgarians are saying is do what you like, but the easiest way, Larry, the most simple way for us to resolve all this, if tomorrow the Bulgarian justice minister was to write to Jack Straw and say to him, we give you permission to release him, it could be done tomorrow. The problem is that the Bulgarians are not carrying out their obligations, and so we've had to take it, Michael's lawyers had to take it the whole way through the legal procedure, and he's right to judicial review. We judicially have to review the government now. It wouldn't be my option to do that, but if it's the only way to get Michael freed, then it's the route that we will take, because we're determined to get a result.
Well, you mentioned that the newspapers over here, you're talking about the Liverpool Echo and the Daily Post, have been saying a lot about freeing Michael.
Yep.
What are the Bulgarian newspapers saying over there about the possibility of him being freed? Are they against that?
Well, what they say is, they say it's up to the UK government. What they say is, when I give quotes saying that my view now is certainly that we should get on with it, if you like, interpreting this convention to say that also the host country, if there's been a miscarriage of justice, should be able to exercise the right of commuting a sentence and freeing him. What they basically say, because Bulgaria did let him down, they don't give that quote. They don't give the quote ever where I said Bulgaria failed a UK citizen. And that's a serious issue in terms of justice in the European Union. How can I send any of my constituents to go to places like Bulgaria and Romania if I have no confidence that they may well be picked up and arrested as the wrong person and end up in prison, you know, with a 15-year prison sentence and a massive fine, by the way, that which Michael Senior and Maria and the family have already paid, and they shouldn't have paid, you know, if in a case that he wasn't guilty. So their view is, do what you like with him. But, you know, what we're finding, and that's why we've got to go through a judicial review procedure, is that the legal niceties are not so simple, that they have a hands-off approach. If they were to put in paper and writing, quite simply, you know, yes, you can free him, that would make a very that would be very easy for Jack Straw to do it and for the government to do it. And I really find it's quite frustrating that the Bulgarian ambassador here in Britain and in Brussels, because I've seen to see him many times, say to me, oh, we want to be helpful, we want to be you know, we want to help you with this case, but they don't effectively, because the most simple way to help is actually to write the letter and allow us to free him, and then allow us to exercise the rights under the convention, which they share responsibility for.
Well, given that you're not going to get that piece of paper with the let him go from one of the Bulgarian officials, realistically then, in the absence of that, how long is Michael going to stay behind bars,
would
you think?
Well, I mean, I sincerely hope, and that's what we're working for, the campaign team is working towards that, is that Michael's lawyer now going to take it to a judicial review procedure, is that I think the first step has been very positive. We now have had leave to take it to a full judicial review, so one High Court judge has already said yes, there is a possibility to release him under this convention. We then have a panel of three court judges. What we're working to and trying to make the case for is that, in fact, in such an extreme case of a miscarriage of justice where the evidence simply wasn't there, that why should we need the agreement of the Bulgarians to release him? It should be enough for us to exercise the one article in the convention, and that's what I hope the ruling will be. I hope that the judges will make that ruling.
Well, how long will that process take?
Well, no, it's happening quite fast now, which again is positive. So we're expecting a court hearing, I think, on the 3rd or 4th of December. So, you know, of course we may not win it, because this is again about the legal issues.
Course, yeah.
And certainly I believe in some ways that this requires, you know, a diplomatic intervention. And I think if the Bulgarians were serious about saying they do want to help in this case, then, you know, they simply should give the agreement and agree that Michael should be released and we wouldn't have an issue.
Well, you're listening to Larry Neild here on City Talk 105.9 with the Commons Touch, and I'm talking to Labour MEP Arlene McCarthy. Arlene, at this stage in the programme, I normally climb into the speaker's chair and fire a few questions. It's one of my luxuries in life, really, to fire questions, because you have to answer them. You know what the rules of the government chambers are. So, are you up for this? Yes?
Yes, absolutely.
Right.
Come on.
Let me ask you, Arlene, where were you born?
I was born in Belfast.
And did you grow up in Belfast? Or
I went to school in Belfast till I was 17 and a half, and then I passed my A-levels and I chose, like everybody in my area, because it was the worst time of the Troubles in Northern Ireland, and yes. my parents wanted us to have a future. My brother had already gone to university in England, and in fact, he's now a professor of biotechnology at Liverpool University, so he's done pretty well. And then I followed. My younger sister studied medicine at Liverpool University. She followed my brother, and she's now a GP in Chester. So we've all... I am probably the one that did, if you like. If people don't think politicians do a good job, or if they have this view that we're not the most attractive job options, then I suppose I may well be the failure, since I've got a biotechnology professor, a doctor, and my other sister's a lawyer, actually.
It could have been worse, Alan. You could have been a journalist. I think it's a toss-up, really.
I think we both do an important job.
So, did you experience any of the Troubles? I mean, it must have been very traumatic in those days.
Well, I mean, I had the very unusual situation that my father was a Catholic and my mother was a Protestant, and in those days people didn't marry across the divide. They chose to. It was kind of a romantic story. He had TB, and he was in the Merchant Navy at the time. He contracted tuberculosis. My mother was his TB nurse, and so they met. And then they decided to take a chance, I suppose. And you know, it wasn't an easy, I think, upbringing. And it's one of the reasons why they chose to send us to a Quaker school, because that either you went to a Catholic school or you went to school that was probably associated more with the Protestant faith. And they made a decision that was better for us personally to go to a Quaker school. And we all went through a school that probably was one of the best schools in Northern Ireland. I do recall being quite nervous when I grew up about, you know, concern, because it was at a time when there were a lot of bomb scares. One of my school friends was on the wrong train at the wrong time and was actually blown up because there was a bomber on the train.
Yes.
So one of my father actually worked in Harland and Wolff shipyard. He worked there. And one of his friends, actually, his daughter, just to get some extra pocket money for weekends and to get away on holidays with her friends, she worked in a petrol station, but she was 16 at the time. And the petrol station, you know, was a station where sometimes they fill different cars up, and nobody knew if they were the cars, I suppose, for the UDA or the UVF or the IRA. She got caught up in a situation where obviously there was money spent on putting petrol into cars that belonged to one or other paramilitary force, and she and the workers were taken into the back and shot through the head. So,
wow.
You know, I have had my experience of violence, which is why I am predominantly a non-violent person. I don't like, I can't tolerate any kind of form of prejudice. I don't like racism, all because I think it leads to divided societies and violence. And it's something I grew up with, and I don't wish to have future generations have to live under the same conditions.
What star sign are you?
Libra. I think a lot of politicians are Libran. Mrs. Thatcher, although I don't like to put myself
really?
In the same category as her.
Oh, really? So she's your cousin in astrology?
She's cousin in astrology, but certainly not in politics or style or ideology, not at all.
Well, I was going to ask you, what schools did you go to? But you mentioned a Quaker school, and that was in Belfast.
Lisburn. Just Lisburn, where there's... Lisburn, in fact, was also renowned. It's got a very big army barracks just at the back of our school, at the back of our playing fields was a big army barracks for the British soldiers in Northern Ireland.
Do you have any pets?
We just had a very sad death of our 18-year-old cat. And in fact, it was quite traumatic, because I went to the Democrats' convention in August, and we set off to go there, and we went to take him about 4 days before up to the local cattery, and he took ill, and we had to take him to the vet. And in fact, we then ended up having him for 2-3 weeks in the vet looking after him, accumulating bills. But fortunately, we had pet insurance, which I would advise all your listeners out there if they got pets to do. But then when we got back, we had him home in a week, and then he tragically died.
Oh, how old was he?
18.
18.
But he had a good life. I always say to my husband, he had a good life.
Wow. You know, you're the second politician to come on here who's lost pets in the run-up to coming on here. I'm not sure whether that's a good or bad thing, really.
Well, yeah, maybe this you don't bring a lot of luck, Larry.
I hope so. Well, I'm a doggy person. I'll have to be very...
Well, I'm a dog person, but my husband grew up as one of seven children, and he was the middle child, which I think is always a difficult one. And because he didn't have enough space, he had to live outside in the garden, little mobile home, because there weren't enough bedrooms in the house. And he lived there with three cats from a young child, so he's always a cat person.
Oh, wow.
And I give in, although my brother has a boxer and a dachshund, and there always have been dogs in our family. I conceded on the cat front.
What inspired you to get into politics?
I suppose what I, you know, what I studied at university, I studied languages, so I speak fluent French and German. I always had an interest in politics, but my interest in politics was very restricted because, you know, when you grew up in Northern Ireland, people saw politics as being very negative, as being very conflictual. Not many women ever went into politics. And one of my father's treats to us when we were kids really was he is still a great reader. Every Friday night we used to go to the local library and we used to get out books. And so I'd rapidly exhausted the fiction section. And then I started to read all the political books in there. And I had a real interest in international politics. And then I had the possibility to go and, you know, I studied German and politics in a university in Germany. I studied French and politics at university in France. And I suppose it was a natural kind of path for me then to look at European politics because I understood a lot of the issues. I had the skills, the language skills, and I then got the opportunity of a research post working for the socialist MEPs in the European Parliament. And when I was there, some of the women said to me, why don't you stand for a seat? You know, if you're active locally at home in your party, we could do with people like you that, you know, that have an understanding of the issues in Europe as well.
So you stood and you were like first-time lucky, really, weren't you?
Well, first of all, I had quite a big job. I was running a PhD at Manchester University. I had a job in terms of European programme management, sort of bringing in all the grants, which is why I had always a big interest in the Objective One funding, because that was my job. My job was to put together proposals, was to get the money in from Brussels. And so I was doing that at the time, and people said to me, have a go. And they said, you won't win. You've got no chance. It's your first chance. And I think because John Smith, who had three daughters, suddenly decided an all-postal ballot for all our selections for Ireland, I think lots of women voted for me. And it wasn't the old smoke-filled rooms where only whoever turned up could select their candidate. Everyone was allowed to vote by post. And so, surprisingly, I won the selection.
But you got more votes in the slate than any other Labour candidate, didn't you?
Well, at the time I was first elected, they said that I would end up, you know, with a 5,000 majority notionally. I had a 51,000 majority in my first election. So I think people perhaps wanted the change of seeing a woman candidate. And maybe I was quite young. You know, at the time I was 33 when I was first elected. I had a lot of energy. I like to think I've still got a lot of energy. Obviously,
yes.
You know, 15 years on, that's somewhat drained. But, you know, I think it's an enormous privilege to be able to represent people, you know, where your job is to get them the benefits of our European membership and help them understand what Europe means for them.
Well, Arlene, I'm going to continue with the questions in a moment or two, but this is Larry Neild here on City Talk 105.9 with the Commons Touch, and I'm going to be talking more in a few moments. Be right back.
The Commons Touch on City Talk 105.9.
I moved into my boyfriend's place 6 weeks ago, and my old flat's still vacant. It hasn't stopped me getting rent.
My investment property's been vacant for 3 weeks, but the mortgage is still covered.
Northwood's unique guaranteed rental income scheme means you'll never miss a penny in rent, even when your property's vacant. No catches, no fees, no insurance policies, just peace of mind. Call Liverpool 256 1035 to guarantee your rent gets paid. Northwood, Liverpool 256 1035.
Are you doing your bit to combat global warming? We are!
By recycling your favourite City Talk shows. Listen again at citytalk.fm/citycasts. Each programme is available for 7 days before being updated. There's also an archive section for the best bits you might have missed.
Saving the planet and entertaining you at the same time.
City Talk 105.9. The Commons Touch on City Talk 105.9.
Welcome back. This is Larry Neild on City Talk 105.9 with the Commons Touch. And my guest today is Arlene McCarthy, Labour MEP for the North West, representing Liverpool over there in Brussels. Arlene, I'll continue with the questions. Who's been the biggest influence on your political career?
Oh, I mean, I think there probably have been many. I mean, everyone will cite someone like Mandela as a real inspiration to politicians, but not because of the personality for me, but because of the patience and endurance that he had, I think, in terms of fighting the cause for the ANC, because, you know, I often think in politics, I get frustrated sometimes at the speed at which things happen. I think, well, if someone can be patient...
You mean the speed or the slowness?
Sorry, the slowness.
Yes.
Well, I mean at the speed of the slowness. And I think patience, look at the patience that man had. So you have to have patience. I cannot not be influenced by the Pankhurst sisters as a woman elected member. You know, they are local heroes for the Northwest. And do you know, I was at the Democrats convention in Denver, and I went along to the women's event where Hillary Clinton was speaking, and they showed a video video of having had 100 years of the vote for women in the US. And who was up there as one of the lead forces? The Pankhurst sisters. So the Northwest went to Denver and to the US to show that we were leading the way. So, I mean, I also think influences, I'm influenced by lots of the people I meet out in local communities, you know, like Mothers Against Violence, Mothers Against Gun, you know, people who don't get paid to do a job and they are voluntarily giving of their time to make life better for people in their own local communities. And, you know, they should be an inspiration to all of us because they're the reason why we're here.
I mean, the good thing about people like that, of course, is because they're not doing it for any money or for any particular self-interest, they're doing it out of a passion and a belief in something.
They are dedicated, they have a commitment, and I think they are the kind of role examples for us as politicians because, you know, we are paid to do a job, but in fact, if I didn't have the connection I have with a lot of those community groups, you know, I think that I am a public servant. I have to keep reminding myself, and all politicians should, that you're a public servant. They're elected to do a job for those people who give up freely of their time and, you know, have that commitment to actually make change in their local communities. It's important we listen to them and work with them.
What's the most difficult decision you've had to make as a politician? Or perhaps in Brussels you don't make any difficult decisions?
Oh, I think we do make difficult decisions quite a lot. I mean, probably some of the most difficult decisions that we had to make was, you know, on voting on the second UN resolution before the Iraq War. I mean, that was a big decision for us, knowing that Britain, you know, did have a different view in terms of the coalition with the US.
What was the decision of the EU?
Well, the decision of the EU, in fact, was to go for a second resolution in the UN and to try and see if they could.
That would have prevented the war.
Well, it wouldn't have done, because in the end, we agreed to have a joint line on these issues. And unfortunately, you know, our UK ambassador made it very clear to us that the EU member states went with a solid line to that UN meeting, and then France broke the ranks on it, which is quite often the case. And that put us in the UK in a very difficult position, because it forced us to take sides when we shouldn't have had to take sides, because we had an EU position. But for us, I suppose, as Labour MEPs, you know, we felt, no, let's give them one more chance. But I don't think it would have made a difference, because I think that it was heading in that direction. But I don't think that, you know, the most difficult decisions for me have not been the political decisions I've made in my life. They've been maybe more the personal decisions I've made in my life. If you decide you're going into politics, you have to recognise that it does, you have to sacrifice social time. And probably my one biggest regret, although I'm not a politician that looks backward or always thinks about the things I didn't do, the one biggest regret I have is probably not being able to have children. But, you know, I think there are many women that have ended up in the same situation. I'm very fortunate to have, in my own local northwest environment, Chester and Liverpool, I have an extended family where I've got lots of nephews and nieces, so I get a lot of joy from my siblings' children.
So what's the best thing about being a politician?
I think the best thing is that if you find that you can change things, and you can change them in a way where you have responded to what local people have asked you to do. And I suppose I think success I've had as a politician, but I wouldn't attribute it to me personally. It was because the local police, you know, the local campaigning organisations and groups like Mothers Against Guns and Mothers Against Violence said to me, well, if we ban handguns in the UK, why are we having guns coming in from Germany and Lithuania? And I said, OK, I'm going to look at it. I'm going to try and find a way to stop the import of these guns. And, you know, in working my way through the kind of legislative system and the kind of technical amendments, I was able to find a way to actually pass an EU law, which means that those kind of sports weapons that were coming in and being converted into firing live ammunition, you know, are now just as rigorously controlled as normal handguns. So they're not so easy for gangs to go over and purchase. But that's not my success. I always hand that back to, you know, to the local community and to people like the police who raised the issue, saying, can you do something about it? Because they said, it's not an issue for our national government MPs. It's something that we need Europe to do.
What's your proudest moment?
Proudest moment about many. I suppose my proudest moment is having my parents at my first election, seeing me be elected, you know, as I was the daughter of a Harland and Wolff shipyard worker, and neither of my parents went to university. My mother never worked after she got married, and my father, you know, was brought us all up on quite a low wage. And I think it was a moment of pride, I think, for them to see their eldest daughter, I suppose, you know, be elected by a large group of people to go and represent them in the European Parliament.
Did your mother say, look, I told you she wasn't going to be a failure?
my well, my father always had, as I think as the eldest daughter, he always had this great hope that I would work in a local bank and, you know, that I would have a sensible job and that I would have children, I'd be a good mother, etc. And I always felt maybe I disappointed him, but in fact they are immensely proud of me. They said to me last week only that we just passed a law on timeshare, and what makes them proud is when they go to their local bowling club, that one of their friends says to them, "Oh, I heard your daughter on Radio Ulster," because I also did something on local Radio Ulster. So I don't think, in the end, I've been a disappointment. But I think there's always a pressure, I think, on the eldest daughter. My parents didn't want me to go. They wanted me to, they didn't mind my brother going to Liverpool, but they wanted me to stay at home. And I think, you know, I had to break the mold for my two younger sisters, who then, you know, we all in the end left, because at the time there was no future in Northern Ireland. But, you know, I found a home from home, because I love people from, I love Merseyside people, because I think there's a big Irish influence. And it's the same in Manchester. I think people have the warmth and the welcoming attitude that Irish people have. So I don't feel that I'm ever have been, in the 20 years I've been here, I feel I'm in a home from home, really.
What one law would you introduce if you could?
What law would I introduce?
If it was in your gift to introduce a law, what would it be?
Oh, that's a really difficult one. Probably, at the moment, if I was introducing law now, I would introduce a law now on the windfall tax on the energy companies. I think one of the issues that I have been quite angry about, and it's good to get angry in politics because it means you still haven't lost your passion, I feel that energy companies that have been posting big profits over the years have continued really not to give consumers a fair deal. And I'm particularly concerned when I get a letter, which I did recently, from a local community group saying that they hadn't received a bill in 5 years, and then they received a bill for £7,000 saying that they should pay it, but they'd had a meter reading, but nobody bothered to actually send them a bill. And I think that's not acceptable for behaviour of big companies, so I probably would regulate them in a way that they are forced to be more transparent in terms of charges. They recognise consumers' rights, because after all, the customers is paying. And I would actually think at this point in time, if they're making massive profits, yes, they have to reinvest in issues like, you know, energy efficiency. I would like them to give every poor home, those that are on a prepaid meter, a smart meter, so that they could help them reduce their costs. So probably that's what I do at the moment. But there's probably lots of other issues I would think about in the long term. But for me, the whole kind of the fact that many people are facing energy rises right across Europe, in France, Germany, it's the same. But I think I would want to get the companies to do more for people, particularly those on poor incomes.
Well, we always exclude Gordon Brown from this question, but do you have a favourite, excluding Gordon Brown, a favourite British Prime Minister?
Well, I think we've been very fortunate recently to have two very good Prime Ministers for very different reasons. I think that, you know, Tony Blair was a statesman, a leader who had tremendous recognition, you know, globally and across the world, and continues to work on his faith foundation and on the Middle East crisis. And, you know, that's because other leaders want him to do that. And, you know, you've then got Gordon Brown currently, you know, when we've had this global financial crisis hit us, who's actually leading the world in terms of finding solutions to it. And I was amazed to see last week that a Nobel Prize winner for economics actually signaled him out as someone who is leading the way in terms of finding the solutions for us in a situation where every country will be hit. In Europe, we've never been so popular in Europe at the moment. All of my colleagues say thank God for Gordon Brown, because they recognise that he is the person with that experience financially to help us turn things around.
Well, that must be music to his ears, won't it? Thank God for Gordon Brown. This is Larry Neild here on City Talk 105.9 with the Commons Touch, and my guest is Arlene McCarthy, Labour MP for the North West. Well, Arlene, it's been a historic week, hasn't it, with Barack Obama, the next President of the United States. Did you think he might just lose?
You know, I had the opportunity, because I sit on the European Parliament's US delegation, I had the opportunity to go to Denver for the convention. And when I was there, the kind of, I have to say, you know, the whole movement for change, the fact that people were out on the street, and, you know, I went to the football stadium for his acceptance speech, and they asked people to text a number on the screen if you wanted to help him win the presidential election. And within 40 minutes, 70,000 people had texted. So, you know, that indicated to me the scale of the desire for change in the US. And, you know, I kept thinking, well, he can't lose. And then when I came back in the sober light of the day, outside of this kind of, you know, big love-in by the Democrat Party, you know, people said to me, well, there will be the race element. But I never believed it, because I felt that he would win. I didn't know that he would. I thought it could be a narrow win, because don't forget that Kennedy, who was a similar kind of leader, he only won by 100,000 votes, by 0.5% in 1960. And, you know, similarly, he had had his big acceptance speech in a baseball stadium. He motivated people who didn't vote. But I think the difference here was young people came out en masse to vote, and it's quite difficult to get young people to vote. They can be quite apathetic, but he gave them the view that this was going to be a quite different presidential campaign and a different president and a different administration. I think a lot of the black community voted. A lot of those people that felt disenfranchised in inner city areas where they saw no hope, no future, he gave them the hope to say, if you vote for me, you know, life will be better under a democratic administration. And but no doubt, you know, he has big challenges. No doubt there are big challenges. I mean, the US is facing worst deficit. The you know, house repossessions, job losses, it's all starting. So he's got to go in there and sort that out. And I don't.
Can he do it? Can he do it? I mean, America's skint, you know, because of the credit crunch, it's major problems. There is a big expectation on his shoulders that he's going to go and help people, particularly help Black America.
Well, he's never promoted himself as the kind of black candidate only for the black community. I mean, clearly he's there to govern for all people, and particularly he always talked about those, you know, the dispossessed or the, you know, those who had, you know, who lost their home ownership, etc. He's there to speak up for the people that are probably are the weaker parts of society. It is a big task for him, but I think what impressed me about him, every time people said to him that he was new, untried, untested, that unlike McCain, he didn't have a long experience in Congress because he had been a one-term senator. He'd only been elected 5 years ago, that he said, and I think that's what matters. I think politicians have to start admitting that they individually don't have all the answers. He said, I don't have all the answers, but I will bring together all the right people to get the solutions. And I think it's quite important to get the right people around the table who do have expertise in areas like the financial crisis and in the economy, and get them to work on a plan to get us out of this mess. Because if America doesn't succeed, unfortunately, we are all on the coattails of the American economy. Every EU country is. And so it's important for us that they do get a grip of their economy and that we see change there. Otherwise, we will suffer financial problems right across Europe. And indeed, China and Asia are having the same problems.
What impact will his election have on Europe?
Well, I think it will have a big impact because the kind of opportunities I had at the Democrats' convention was that every day I went to the seminars, and then in the night I went into the convention to listen to the speeches. And we had one seminar about what will a Democrat president look like for Europe. And Bill Clinton came along to speak to it. And for us, it was you know, a rare opportunity to hear Bill Clinton speak about what the Democrats' priorities are. And he said that Obama's priorities would be the same as his were, that we would move away from this kind of Bush unilateralist approach. So a multilateral approach in terms of engaging in all the big debates in Europe and the international discussions about climate change, about how we use power. Clinton, I thought, gave a great comment. He said, look, America is always a better leader in the world, is more respected when we use the example, when you use the power of example rather than example of power. And by that he meant soft diplomacy works. Let's not always be looking to see where we send troops in. Military might is not the answer, was effectively his message. And he said that this would be what Obama or a Democrat president would do. They would engage with the community. And I think, you know, we have big challenges in Afghanistan, Iraq still. And I think here Obama will be a better conciliator. And, you know, women like, you know, the Mary Stopes organization internationally, they've had difficulty in trying to work in places like Africa because the Bush administration didn't want to help women with managed reproductive rights. Yet we know that there are 500,000 women in Africa who die, you know, in childbirth. Maternal mortality is a massive problem. And Obama doesn't have that ideology. He will allow and promote organizations to work via the UN to support, you know, solutions in the developing world. As you know, Kenya had a national day off to honor him because he was also a son of Kenya that became the US president. Now, where else would you see that? You wouldn't see someone in any other, I think, in any other area becoming a president who had that kind of background. So he definitely is, I think, a sign for big change. And let's hope he can meet up to the expectations that are put on him.
Well, just yesterday, Trevor Phillips, who's the chairman of the Equality and Human Rights Commission, said that under British politics, there would be Barack Obama could not become the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom Parliament.
Well, you know, I have a lot of respect for Trevor Phillips, and I think the point he was trying to make, really a political point, which is an important point to make, and I support that, is let's look at how we make sure that our parties and our government are more representative of the communities that we represent. So we have you know, Chinese, Asian communities, we have Afro-Caribbean communities, and obviously they should be able to have an equal chance to become a locally elected politician, or an equal chance to get the prime post of prime minister. But the comparison for me is wrong, because, you know, let's be clear about this. Yes, you know, he was the son of a Kenyan and didn't have a lot of money, but Barack Obama only got to where he is because he is one of the country's black elite now. You have to have masses of money to be able to make any attempt to get in the Senate or to be a congressperson. It's so fundamentally different from our system. You know, one of my American friends said to me, Arnie, I don't understand how you got elected, because you couldn't get elected in the US system as a woman unless you had big money behind you. And of course, Obama raised, you know, $200 million on an internet campaign where ordinary people were giving him $5, $10. But the reality is, big money is behind who gets elected to the Congress and Senate. So let's not be naive about that. And I think that there is a chance, obviously, if parties, and certainly we have done that with women, we've gone for women-only shortlists, that has been criticised. As a consequence, we have more women in Parliament than any other political party. And so sometimes you have to look at mechanisms to... But in the end, for me, the mechanisms are not the answer. It's about changing the culture so people recognise that they would vote for a black man or an Asian candidate because they had the skills. And that's what Trevor Phillips, I think, hasn't seen very clearly. People voted also for Obama not just because he was the first black candidate, but because he is a man of immense charisma. He is a very, you know, a man who communicates very easily with people, and was prepared to say, I am the person that wants to work for you. And I thought, again, kept saying to the American people, it's your victory. You voted for me. You came out, you asked for change. Now I have to work for you. So it isn't just about the simple politics of colour or race. I think it's about once in a lifetime, in a generation, a person comes along who's that little bit special. I think Clinton was like that. I think Blair had that. And I think Obama is the same kind of charismatic leader that people put their faith in.
So in just one word, is he going to be a great president?
I think he's going to be a very good president. And I think, for me, I think he'll be a great president because he's prepared to say, I personally don't have the answer. I don't think Bush ever was prepared to say that. And where I need a solution to something, I will bring round that table the people who will make sure we get the best deal and the best policies for the American people. And all I hope is that he won't be sucked into, in these difficult economic times, putting only America first and being protectionist, shutting down the barriers, not engaging in international trade, because we need trade to make sure that the world economy functions and that everybody gets a slice of the growth and the jobs. We want the growth and the jobs that come out of that. We don't want America to put up protectionist barriers and not engage, you know, with other countries in terms of trade relations.
This is City Talk 105.9. You're listening to The Commons Touch with me, Larry Neild. I'll be back with more after this.
The Commons Touch on City Talk 105.9.
City Talk 105.9's Cash for Kids is looking for a full-time charity manager. Working alongside the existing charity team, the successful applicant will create and implement fundraising events and ideas, deliver business plans, and outline the charity's objectives and goals. Exciting, demanding, and rewarding, this role requires fundraising experience and exceptional interpersonal skills. So if you could make a difference to disadvantaged kids in this area, phone City Talk 105.9's Cash for Kids on 472 6827.
City Talk 105.9 and the Liverpool Philharmonic Hall present the legendary Aletta Adams, performing live on Wednesday, 3rd of December, featuring the stunning sounds of the Kingdom Choir and some of America's finest musicians. Join Aletta Adams for an unforgettable evening of Christmas and gospel classics. Tickets are on sale now. Log on to aletaadams.co.uk or call the box office on 709-3789. Aletta Adams at the Liverpool Philharmonic Hall with City Talk 105.9.
The voice of Liverpool.
City Talk 105.9. This is The Commons Touch.
The Commons Touch.
On City Talk 105.9.
Welcome back. This is Larry Neild on City Talk 105.9 with The Commons Touch. And my guest today is Arlene McCarthy, Labour MEP for Liverpool and indeed the rest of the North West. Arlene, you mentioned before that if you had your way, you'd bring in a windfall tax. One of the things that I can't fathom out is we're all in the EU. A lot of our energy companies are now owned by French companies particularly. How can we tolerate having different prices for fuel, for gas and electricity in the United Kingdom than, say, the people in French pay, even though it's coming from the same company?
Well, I mean, I think the point is that we had, I mean, it's a very interesting debate. It's a technical debate. I mean, under the Conservative government, they liberalised the energy market, as you remember, and the idea was to get more choice, more competition in. And of course, that has worked in a very limited way, which meant for a long time, actually, we have been paying lower prices than the French or the Germans. And so now the increase seems to us to be much more, because in Germany and France, they've actually been paying a little bit more than we have for energy. The French have been in a better position because they've gone for big nuclear options. Now, you know, that's always been a very difficult debate for us here in the UK, you know, that many people don't want to develop more nuclear options for energy. But the French don't have an issue with that. They don't have an ideological issue with it. So they've had cheaper energy via their nuclear sources. And they've been storing that nuclear energy for a longer time. But the point you make about the markets, again, what I take on, you know, as a Euro MP for my own region is that, OK, so we now have German and French companies that are providing energy here for us locally. And, you know, my concern really is that we have a consumer's charter for energy that goes right across the EU, which, again, is about issues like transparency of charging, which is in terms of, you know, I think, and I've always said it's fundamentally wrong that, you know, people on prepaid meters should be paying more than someone that can afford to be in a direct debit. And so, you know, the issue for me is really that the French government still owns most of EDF. So it's the French government that is saying that they're refusing to liberalise their market. This is one of the big battles we have in Europe. And the French energy companies are saying to EDF, we don't allow you to increase the energy price by more than 6%, because they are the key owner, share owner in EDF, and they don't want to allow other companies to come in. In the case of Germany, some of the local authorities own the German energy network, so, you know, they set the rates and prices. So, I certainly wrote to the Commissioner for Energy recently saying that I felt that the liberalisation of the energy market had been a failure, because it's okay for us to say, under the Conservative years, that we liberalised our markets and we allow other companies to come in. We can't get into their markets, you know, so we can't get to actually compete in other markets. But at the end of the day, the kind of costs and charging are something that are left up to the...
But if they liberalised it, what would happen, of course, is they wouldn't reduce prices here. They'd probably just bump them up in France and Germany.
Well, and they have been increasing them. And they, you know, it's only because the French government has a share in EDF that they put a cap on that. But in fact, in reality, French and Germans have been, over the last 10 years, because they didn't have a liberalised market, they've been paying more than British consumers. But that doesn't matter so much when you suddenly get an increase, does it? People don't see, you know, where the differences are. People pay a lot for energy in other EU countries, and they pay a lot in taxes, you know. They have a much higher tax regime. So many of my colleagues say that their constituents are really feeling the full force and brunt of the current financial crisis, and it's tough for them because energy is expensive in all EU countries. And who's holding the purse strings? Well, in reality, it's Russia that's the problem for us, and that's why you do need Europe and you need to have these kind of bilateral discussions, because Russia, for some reason, the price of gas has been pegged to the price of oil. And why that should be the case, I don't know. Russia's the biggest exporter of gas. They have dictated a price in that, saying it should be the same price for oil. But we're beginning to see the oil prices come down now, and we've seen that, you know, in the petrol stations, that people are paying less. But in terms of energy, they should be passing on these lower costs onto consumers, rather than saying we need to save for a rainy day, or we need to save to make sure that we put in better infrastructure. I think people want to see the savings now in their pocket, rather than wait several years for that.
Earlier this week, the European Parliament made an important decision about working hours. I mean, I'm wondering whether I should start taking up stamp collecting or train spotting or something, because I'm going to have loads of time on my hands, I guess.
Well, we haven't made a decision yet, so we should be clear about how it works. But what's happened is the Committee for Employment, the Social Affairs and Employment Committee, has voted on a proposal which, you know, the way they voted would end the opt-out that Britain currently has from the Working Time Directive.
At the moment, the European law is that you're not allowed to work more than 48 hours a week.
Well, it's not... Well, that actually, that's a very good question, because that is the crux of the debate. Because we're arguing, is it 48 hours a week? No. What we're saying is that we should measure that annually over an annual reference of 12 months, which would effectively mean that you probably would be allowed to work in some cases 60 to 70 hours a week. And for me, the issue is that I feel that we have to find the right balance in this, because on the one hand, we've had a situation where some abusive employers, those exploiting people, are forcing people to work very long hours and have sometimes said to them, I won't give you a contract unless you'll sign up to working these hours. That cannot be right, and we have to protect people from being forced into working longer hours. However, there's a difference for me that if you choose to work longer hours, you should still be allowed to work longer hours, because what I know from talking to people locally is, again, you know, at a time of recession, I think what people don't want is to feel that Brussels is saying you can't work overtime, or Brussels is saying you must take a pay cut. I think what we are saying is people have to have the flexibility and choice, because you recognise that there are times in people's lives, you know, when they have a young family, when maybe one person is not able to work, that one may want to work longer hours. You may have some people working part-time. So for us, it's a balance of how do you ensure proper protection, proper rights for working people, no abuse that they are forced to work longer hours. But at the same time, you have the flexibility in a time of recession for people to work extra hours if they need extra money. And that will be what the final debate will come down to, whether we can find a resolution that allows people to do both effectively.
The problem I have is that if you give the employers the legal opportunity to, if you like, force, cajole employees to work long hours, they're going to take it. You know, I think that if you have some airy-fairy language that gives them a get-out clause, we will never end long hours, unpaid overtime, that we see particularly in Britain. You see the reports, you've seen the TUC have produced loads of reports on saying a large number of people in the British economy are working long hours, unpaid hours, because they're forced to do so, because they're afraid.
Yes, and that's what we have to end.
How can you end that?
We have to end the compulsion of people being doing that, because you have to put better protection in terms of contracts, so that people have rights at work and they're not forced to work. When I was out campaigning once in Bootle, you know, in the last European election, because this was also a live issue then, is that, you know, a local person came up to me in the street and said that, you know, he actually said what I'm saying. He said, look, I sometimes do want to work longer hours, you know, and I don't want to be stopped doing that. But on the other hand, he said, I recently went for a job application where the person tried to make me sign, which is illegal, by the way, it's illegal under UK law, tried to make me sign a contract saying that I would work a 70, 80 hour week. And when I said I wouldn't sign it, then they wouldn't give me the job. So this is the kind of abuse and practice that we do have to stop. We have to get away from the longer working hours culture, but nonetheless, you have to have the flexibility that some people may decide they want to have a second job. You know, I mean, I know people, women part-time, who want to work part-time because they've got children, but they may want to top that up sometimes, you know, working.
What do they do in Europe? I mean, do people there work just like 48 hours, or do they do overtime there?
Well, I think what you will find in Europe is that probably a lot of the, you know, they have, the French, for example, have very strict controls on what hours that you can work. It's not incoincidental then that they have got a problem in terms of productivity of the economy. But I think what they also do is, you know, what you will see is if you look at the people that are working very long hours, tragically, I think they're quite, you know, where do you find long hours working in the kind of, you know, hotel and leisure sector, bars, etc.? You will find that they are quite often are migrant workers. They're quite often Polish workers or workers from other countries. You know, I went to the MTV Awards. Nearly everybody that served me late at night was actually not a person from Liverpool, actually. They were Polish workers working in the local hotel.
You're listening to Larry Neild here on City Talk 105.9 with the Commons Touch. And I'm talking to Arlene McCarthy, the Labour MEP for the North West, including Liverpool. Arlene, Gordon Brown, he must be very happy this week after the by-election result from Scotland. Were you expecting such a big win for Labour?
Well, I think that we don't have expectations anymore, because, you know, when you're in a third term administration, you know, the Tories were losing seats when they were in their third term hand over fist. Every time there was a by-election, they lost it. So, you know, we always have the view now that you can, if you're the government, you know, if you're the party of the government, that you may lose seats. I think that we were unprepared for the scale of the win, actually. I think that we didn't just hold the seat. I heard people saying, oh, so why are you excited because you only held the seat that you already had? But we didn't just hold the seat. We actually increased our majority, which is quite unusual for a party in government to be doing that. And I think It was because I think people felt in these times of uncertainty, the fact that the local SNP Fife Run Council was increasing taxes all the time.
The SNP is the Scottish National Party.
Scottish National Party, I think.
And they were expecting to win, weren't they?
Well, they were, and I think they thought they could win simply because Labour should be unpopular because we're in government. But I think voters are clever. I never take voters for granted. And what they did in this situation was thought, well, look, the local SNP-run council is not giving me good value for money or helping me in the current situation. I'm going to put my faith in Gordon Brown and the party nationally, where they have got the answers and to the current financial problems that we have. So they decided to put their trust in Labour in this case. And, you know, that doesn't surprise me because recently I was talking to one of our local businessmen and I asked him how they felt we were doing. He said, look, if you ask me at the moment, if I had £10 to spare, who would I give it to look after? It would be Gordon Brown rather than anybody else. So I think it's a sign of the times. I think it's the sign of the fact that we as a party prove that we can deal with the economy and that people feel safer under Labour in what are turbulent times globally.
It's unbelievable that a few weeks ago people were talking about Gordon Brown's premiership in terms of days or weeks, and now he's the miracle man.
Yes, but why is that? That's because I think in politics in general, and it's not just a case for the UK, is because we've turned politics a little bit into a kind of, you know, circus show, where a little bit like Big Brother, it's what you look like, it's what you say, you know, and it's about popularity rather than, you know, and not about, you know, what you're delivering. And I think, you know, Gordon said it all, I think, at our party conference. He said, people say I'm too serious. And then he said, yes, and I am a serious man for serious times. And I think that is what people want. They don't want somebody necessarily who looks sharp in a good suit, who can talk a good talk. They actually want somebody that is going to deliver for them. And I think, you know, in the current times that we face, people want security, stability. They don't want to risk to make a change for something that they don't know and maybe isn't going to help them deal with the problems that they deal with locally. I mean, you know, I always feel that I stand as a politician because I want to be on the side of people that need help. And there are a lot of people that currently need our support, you know, as we go through economically difficult times.
Do you think that Gordon Brown will bring Britain out of the current credit climate?
Economic climate, yeah. Well, I think Gordon Brown is not only working to bring Britain out of the economic climate because everything, you know, the world is now a multi-interdependent state where, you know, finances and everything flows across borders. So finances don't, I saw some statistics last week saying 8,000 banks operate cross-border across Europe. That's a lot of, you know, banks that are working not, you know, in different member states. So, you know, I think he will bring Britain out, but the fact that he is actually helping Europe lead the way and finding the right solutions to deal with the current crisis. And he's playing his role globally as well. So I think that we're very lucky at the moment to have someone that has that kind of experience and skill. And I think that people don't want to take a chance on something that they don't know and where they don't know whether other parties can run the economy. We've proven we can do it. And I think that he certainly is putting in place the right kind of procedures and mechanisms. He is admitting we may have to increase public debt in order to support people. The Tories still won't accept that, even though, you know, major significant international economists say that if you're going through a crisis, you have to borrow sometimes to help people get through the crisis. There's no point having an ideology that we don't borrow, and tax cuts on their own simply won't do it. Although I think we will now see in the future a number of tax cuts to help people through these difficult times. And it's the right way to do it because we have to make sure our businesses don't go down. We have to make sure that people aren't ending up in a situation where they're fearful for their jobs and for their own livelihoods. And I believe he will take the right decision to do that.
Big question, Arlene. Do you think Gordon Brown should have a general election, a snap election, say January or February?
You know, I've just been to a meeting of my party board this morning, and it never came up, in fact, at all. We never had one discussion about whether we should now have an early general election. We were focused very much on what do we need to do now in the immediate future? How do we need to reassure people that we are on their side and working for them? So, you know, I don't think it's useful to have speculation about when a general election is going to happen. I mean, we do have to have one by 2010, that's clear, because the rules say that. But I think the key issue which Gordon and Alistair Darling are focused on is trying to make sure that we get the economy functioning and running in a way that we don't end up, you know, with you know, I think other countries will go into massive recession across Europe. We're focused on making sure that, you know, we minimise the impact of a global recession to the UK, and that's got to be the key priority at the moment. And as for a general election, well, you know, we will have to see when, you know, the time effectively is right that people want to elect a new government. But we've got a job to do immediately, which I think is more important than speculating about when we'd have an election.
But it must be very tempting for Gordon Brown to think on the, you know, riding on the Obama factor, and the fact is that under his stewardship, the economy seems to be in good hands, is riding high, his ratings are going up. He must be tempted to think, if I go to the country now and Labour gets back into government, that gives him a mandate to really roll his sleeves up for the next 5 years and sort the country out.
Yes, but I think we've got more to do in the immediate that are emergency and necessary responses that we've got to really focus on to put in place the right kind of economic structures to take us through a recession. So I think that has to be the priority. And we have got an election coming up. We've got the European elections in June. So, you know, we are having an election, and I hope that lots of people out there will go out and cast their vote, because it's also important who you send to represent you in Europe.
So that's next June. That will be across Europe or United Kingdom?
It's across Europe. Everybody votes more or less on the same 2-3 days, and it's right across the EU. And, you know, I hope that people understand that, you know, Europe is relevant to our current security, our stability, whether it's fighting crime in terms of the gun issues, whether it's finding solutions to the current, you know, global crisis. We need to do that jointly, whether it's climate change. We can only do these things working in cooperation with other EU member states. And again, you know, Gordon's very determined to be in the leader of the pack in terms of taking forward these issues, which have benefits not just for the UK, but for our constituents here in the North West region.
Well, this is Larry Neild here on City Talk 105.9 with the Commons Touch, and my guest today has been Arlene McCarthy, Labour MP for the North West, including Liverpool. Arlene, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, I enjoyed it.
I'll see you again sometime. Have a good afternoon, and thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
The Commons Touch on City Talk 105.9. Listen, and log on to the voice of Liverpool. City Talk 105.9.